Today is Sunday, November 29th, 2020. This is a part three Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Claire Donato, last name spelled D-O-N-A-T-O. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Claire. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, Tom.
Great. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
You may.
Thank you. We wrapped up part two. You had broken your finger, and they had put in an external fixator, which didn't work real well. And you talked about mule accidents and that you'd gone to horseshoeing school. And could you just sort of pick that up again?
I've kind of been browsing through some old pictures to try and get a timeline better in my memory. We had some projects, fencing projects that we did in 1981, in the spring and the fall. That was before my broken finger.
Okay. Where were they and what did they involve?
The one in the spring was at Lake Mead, and we were trying to keep the burros from wandering into the canyon or the park service.
Oh.
From Lake Mead Recreation Area.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know how it came about, but there was, there was probably a crew of six or something, and we went, I guess we stayed in Meadview at a trailer, and we had a boat, and we would go across the lake, and we had barbed wire and T-post, and we were stretching a fence down from, I guess, some sort of cliff to the lake.
So this
and
would
we
be
went
the,
into the lake.
This would be the Grand Wash Cliffs there. The
I don't remember for sure.
Okay, boundary be up
I know
there
we
somewhere.
Worked down. You know, we were from Meadview, and we went across the lake.
Okay.
I can't give you particulars on exactly the whereabouts.
So not too terribly far up lake? Like not up into the canyon, up toward Columbine Falls? Did you go up that far?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
But
so how did you build fence in the water?
Well, you know, I was trying to think about that because it got pretty rocky in there. But I don't know if we drilled and then put the T-post in there. I had never built barbed wire fence before.
Okay.
So, but I remember us, like, pairing off into twos and having contests on who could pound the most posts.
Oh, boy.
In a certain period of time. So, you know, we were always competitive that way. But, and then you stretch the wire. And I know we went into the lake somewhat, but I learned shortly thereafter that the lake levels had dropped so that the fence was just sticking out in dry land and could easily be walked around.
Right. Huh, because it's way low now, and there's no fence coming down to the river.
Right, it's way low now. I was shocked to see it and Lake Powell in 2015. I was just shocked.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So then
that was a fun little project.
Would you set up, every now and then, you'd set up a larger post with cross braces to, like, anchor, to, like, pull the fence towards, to tighten it up?
Yeah, well, it seemed like this was a pretty straight line, but we were going to have those braces every so often and on any corners.
Okay.
But I don't remember much on corners, but I know we did have to do some bracing.
Okay.
But
and did you see a lot of burros out there when you were doing that?
No, not a one.
Okay. Any cattle?
Nope, didn't see any cattle.
Okay, because they run cattle out there too, besides the burros, huh?
Well, that was sort of our our job on the fall fence project was we went out on the Havasupai Reservation on the Esplanade.
Oh.
And built fence enclosures to determine how much damage grazing was doing to the area.
Tell me about that.
Well, that was a lot of helicopter flying because they flew everything in. And there was groups of us. There was like three in my group. I think it was Stanley and me and Candido. And we camped out there. That was kind of really my first camping out there because every place else, you know, we had bunkhouses and corrals and stuff. We didn't have any mules with us.
Wow.
But
nice.
So we would just build, you know, these square enclosures to keep the cattle from grazing there to determine the difference between where they couldn't graze and where they were grazing.
Okay.
So I don't know what they found out about that, but we did helicopters and sling loads, and I remember being in the passenger seat, and we went to pick up, and the sling load was too heavy, and he dropped back down, and I didn't think you were supposed to have passengers when you're sling loading, but anyway, they're pulling stuff out. And I remember looking down going, don't pull the water out. Don't pull the water out. Which was exactly what they were pulling out. But,
oh, my gosh.
It eventually came in on a later
later ship. Oh, my gosh. How many days were you out there then?
I don't remember. It might have been a tour, but I kind of not thinking so. I think we built several fence enclosures, and there was different groups of us. So we were in different areas of the reservation. And I don't know what became of that, so.
So that area had, in the 90s, in the 2000s, had a large population of horses in it. And the excrement from the horses would be top of your boot high. Piles of, and this is a real question of, well, how much use is too much out there? Did you see any wild horses? I didn't know they had cattle out there, but.
Well, and I'm not sure it was cattle. Maybe it was horses.
Okay.
Again, I didn't see any wildlife at all.
Okay. Did you get a chance to like walk out to the edge of the Supai and peep over the edge?
Yeah, a little bit. We were kind of camped.
Uh-huh.
Seems close to the edge.
Wow.
So, it was a beautiful place to be.
Gosh.
And another great little project that I got in on.
Nice.
So, yeah.
That sounds like fun.
It was more, you know, getting to see more of the canyon.
Did Stan and Candido enjoy it as well?
Yeah, they're more used to it. I mean, I can remember my first day, I was like, you know, how can y'all sit there and eat lunch when there's, you know, I mean, it was like, this view is magnificent. So
it is gorgeous.
They were more hardened to it than
I see.
South Carolina girl would be.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, cool. Fun. What else?
Well, let's see. We had the following year. Well, that Christmas, actually, Sue and I decided to travel to San Francisco and have Christmas dinner with a mutual friend of ours' sister.
Okay.
We had never been to San Francisco, and then one of the trail crew guys, Ken Kehoe, who was one of the few white guys on the crew, he was headed that way too, and he wanted to come with us and help us drive, because we were just going to drive straight through.
Okay.
And I should have known it was going to be a bad trip, because it had an ominous start, but she had a she had a Toyota with a camper on the back, and so we figured two people could be up front keeping each other awake, and one person could sleep in the back, and we just sort of rotate.
Yeah.
But we stopped at, I don't know where it was. We were still in Arizona, I think. I just remember it being dark. And we stopped to get gas and filled up, and I went in. I think we were switching drivers. I was going to drive, and I went in the store to get something, and coffee or something, and she went in to get something, and off we went. And pretty soon we're getting pulled over because we hadn't paid for our gas.
Ooh.
And I thought she had paid, and she thought I had paid.
Oh, no.
And neither one of us had paid. So we couldn't pay the cop. We had to turn around and go back, and he was going to make sure we did. So we did, and we paid them and said, sorry, we really thought each other had paid. So at that point, we had to wake Ken up as it's your turn to drive, and we were in the same place that you know, he had gone to sleep in. But we made it to San Francisco without further ado and had a great Christmas. We walked down to the market and bought all sorts of seafood and had a seafood Christmas dinner.
Oh, you must have liked that.
I loved that. And Ken went, whatever he was going to do, that was as far as he was going with us. And on the way back, we decided to stop in Yosemite and check it out. And we were going to just camp there. And so we had parked and went into the general store to get some groceries for a couple of days. And so we're in the grocery checkout line. I had seen some bandanas in that. And I wear a lot of bandanas for work and stuff to keep my hair out of my face.
Uh-huh.
And there was a white one. I didn't have a white one, so I grabbed it. And we're going through our checkout line, and the clerk says, well, you can't buy this bandana here. This is for groceries only. You have to go to the clothing department. And I said, okay, that's kind of silly. But so Sue took a bag, and I took a bag, and she was headed out. I presume to wait for me outside or head to the truck. I don't know. I went over to the clothing area to buy this $1.59 bandana. And I come around, and there's this line that's going all the way around. I mean, it's just hugely long. And most of these people have all these clothes hanging over their arms that they're going to buy. And I have one $1.59 bandana, and I'm standing in line for a while, and then I'm going, I don't know where Sue is, so I just said the hell with it and chunked it in my bag and walked outside. So I'm standing outside looking both ways trying to find where Sue went, and there's a tap on my shoulder, and I said, hi, and he goes, I need to talk to you about a bandana. And I said, oh, yeah, this one. I pulled it out of my bag. And he says, yeah, that one. And so he paraded me back through the store and into this little cluttered room. He was a security guard. And he called the Rangers. So a Ranger comes, and he was actually pretty nice to me. You know, he looked like, really, this is what you called me for? But he had, you know, they were going to press charges, so there was nothing he could do. So he was arresting me, said he was going to have to handcuff me. And I went, really? And then I said, do you have to shove me in the back seat? Can I sit in the front? And so he let me sit in the front, handcuffed, and as we're driving to the jail, I said, there's Sue's truck. That's her truck. And, he drove by it, but we didn't see Sue. And he goes, I'll come back and put a note on it for you. And I went, okay, thank you, because she's not going to have any idea what's happened.
Right.
So they, you know, stripped me and put me in a little orange suit and shoved me in a cell and gave me some magazines. And I'm hanging out there for, I don't know, 4 hours or more. And here come a bunch of Rangers. And said, okay, we've talked to Grand Canyon. And we will let you out in your own recognizance if you sign this piece of paper. And I said, well, what is this? And he goes, you're just going to help out the law enforcement division over there. You know, it won't be anything against your morals. But if you, you know, see somebody stealing a bike from the YACC camp or this, that, and the other, you know, you just let them know. And I went, well, okay, so I signed it, and the nice ranger took me back. We drove around the campground looking for Sue and found her, and he dropped me off. And that night was real restless for me, and I'm crying, and I don't like it. And I said, I'm just going to go in and say, I'm not doing this. I mean, I'm just going to take the consequences. Because I just didn't like this whole sign the paper deal.
Yeah.
And my arraignment, or whatever it was going to be like in 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I got up and went over there and told the Rangers, I didn't want to do this. I'll just take my lumps. And so they tore it up. So Sue and I ran around, you know, just exploring a little bit until it was time for my court appearance. And I'm sitting there waiting to go in. And like 5 minutes before I'm due to go in, here come the Rangers. Papers in their hand. And they said, well, you're going to lose your job at Grand Canyon if you don't sign this.
Whoa.
And I can't lose my job. I, you know, I love that job. I can't lose my job there. That's the best job I've ever had. So, I signed the papers. And in I went, and, you know, it took 5 minutes. The judge went, blah, blah, blah. I went, yeah, I signed the paper, and out I went. And he goes, and so the ranger told me, and I don't remember any names or anything. He said, you know, just give it a couple of, get back to Grand Canyon, give it a couple of weeks, and then go see the head investigator. And David is all I can remember. It was Mr. David somebody. I can't remember his last name. And so I said, okay, that, you know, Sue knew, but now I have this secret. It's all driving me crazy. So I get back to work, and then I waited 2 weeks. I made an appointment with this guy, and I went in, and I said, okay, well, I didn't see anybody stealing bicycles this week, so are we good here? And that's not what he wanted to know about. He wanted to know about drugs, and he wanted to know about Richard in particular, and what his drug use was. And I'm going, I have no idea.
Okay, this is Richard Hanson, Hanson, and he is
the trail
crew foreman. Yeah, okay.
So I said, I have no idea. He's my boss. I don't have that kind of connection with him, you know. So I was getting all upset. And I'm going, this was supposed to be, you know, if I saw somebody doing something wrong. And he goes, well, this, I said, well, I don't hang out with him. He's my boss. So I'm getting more and more upset. And he's understanding that I really don't have a clue, you know, what Richard's drug dealings would be, if any. And so then he started talking about the trail crew. And I said, well, what about the trail crew? And he said, well, I want to know their pot smoking habits and where they get it and how often they smoke it. And I And I said, I don't know any of that stuff, you know. You want somebody who smokes pot, I smoke pot. Here I am. I'm not telling you any of that stuff. And so I'm crying and hyperventilating and, like, this is my first, like, real law enforcement experience.
Yeah, wow.
And he goes, okay, just calm down. Calm down. I'll take this up in another 2 weeks. And I bolted right out of there. So then I said, okay, well, there's got to be a way to get out of this somehow. And I'm thinking, lawyer. I need a lawyer. And I had been seeing one of the wranglers over at Fred Harvey Mule Barn, and he was actually the assistant manager at the time. And he was a bit of a bad boy, so I thought maybe he knows a lawyer. So I went over there and tracked him down, and sure enough, he knew a lawyer in Flagstaff, and he called him and then handed the phone over to me, and I kind of told him the situation, and we made an appointment, and I drove down to Flagstaff to see him, and he made two phone calls, one to Yosemite and one to Grand Canyon, and charged me $115 and says, you're good. You're going to, because I was going to have to see this investigator for like 6 months. That was part of the
wow
piece of paper I had signed. And he goes, you're still going to have to fill that out, but they're not going to ask you any more about this drug situation. And I went, perfect. So the next time I saw him, the investigator.
Did you go back like on that 2 week frequency, or did you wait 6 months to go back?
No, I waited. It was the 2 week frequency the next time I went in, and I might have gone one more time. I can't remember, but I didn't make it. Didn't make it the 6 months because he eventually said, "Go on, get out of here. I don't want to see your face again."
Huh?
And I went, "Done, gone."
Wow.
So yeah, so there's my law enforcement experience, and I didn't get in any more trouble.
Good for you. Oh my.
Huh. But yeah, I can't remember the investigator's name. All I can really remember is David, and I'm not terribly sure that that's correct.
Okay.
So, and I'm not terribly sure if that was the Christmas of 1980 or 1981, but
okay.
Yeah, so I don't know. It was the next Christmas, I think. Sue gave me a white bandana for Christmas.
Oh, that's touching.
And it had kind of lost its appeal at that point.
She did gave it to you as a joke. Oh my gosh, I wonder.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I didn't even tell Richard any of this until much later. I mean, it might have been after we moved up here. I mean, he didn't know any of that at the time. But, yeah, so.
Yeah. Huh. You know, the trail crew has a reputation, at least on the river, for, how should I say it, maybe excessive partying?
That's not just on the river.
Okay. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, everybody, you know, it's just sort of a work hard, play hard
okay.
sort of a mentality.
Yep.
And so, like I said, when we brought down the pony kegs, you know, I mean, we would work our 9 hours very hard from like 6 to 3:30, and then it was time to play.
Okay.
So, that's just how it was.
You know, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about this if you're willing, because that concept seemed to then spill over into the River Rangers, and things kind of went south on the river. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, I don't know
if
you know.
Is this the harassment sexual harassment.
Yeah.
I had read about that. I never ran into that one. I was on the river. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just think it can be a prevalent situation anywhere you are.
Yeah.
You know, as women's always sort of had to battle that sort of thing.
Did you have anybody, you know, while you were working or when you were on your off time when you were working, you know, try to intimidate you into doing something you didn't want to do?
No, not sexually. I mean, the Rangers intimidated me into doing and signing this paper to try and turn somebody in for drugs. And,
right.
And that was the biggest intimidation I had ever gotten.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, like you said earlier, Kim Crumbo was sort of an intimidating character, but he didn't intimidate me. You know what I mean? It was just to see him being all, you know, buff and serious about his job, but he didn't physically intimidate me in any way. Or,
right.
You know, whether it had to do with work or anything. It was just my vision of a... Yeah, this guy means business.
Yeah, an aura of respect is different from flat-out intimidation.
Right.
And that's those two things are very different. But
right.
Yeah, in one of these interviews, you know, that concept of, hey, when I clock out, you know, I work a 9 or I work a 10-hour day, and then it's my time.
Right.
I should ask you then, in the realm of trail crew, if you wanted happy employees and you wanted them to be hardworking and have a good time, how would you, Claire, manage that based on your experiences so that things didn't get out of hand on the off hours?
Right. But I don't know, because we were kind of a drinking crowd. I remember that.
And mm-hmm.
We would go down sometimes on a full moon down to the corrals and we called it yo-bobbing. As the mules came around, you'd sit on the fence, and as the mules came around, you'd jump on their back and see how long you could stay on. But, I mean, I guess that kind of got out of hand a little bit. We didn't do it real often, but you certainly could have gotten hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. You just have to lay some ground rules and some boundaries, you know, like what... When I got up here, there was a lot of drinking going on, and they wanted that I only had so many mules. So I would say you get one case of beer each. You know, like I just set limits because I didn't have the capacity to take all the beer they wanted to take. So I said, you get a case of beer each, and, you know, bring a bottle. That's easier to pack.
Yeah. So that's a simple way of dealing with it, which is moderation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that still allows some drinking, but not, you know, not so much that
they
things...
could have stopped us from bringing down pony cakes. But they didn't.
Right. Right. Okay. No, that... Thank you. That's certainly, I think, a more moderate way of handling something like that, especially looking forward, because Grand Canyon National Park needs a trail crew, and one could argue they need a Navy. And so if that happens again in the future, how are they going to not go back into the problems that they had before?
Right.
Okay. was horseshoeing like?
Well, it's interesting. So, and at some point, Richard sat me down and said, what is it that you want to do with your Park Service career? And I went, well, I think I'd like to be a packer. And, you know, I wasn't considered a packer. I was considered trail crew at Grand Canyon.
Oh.
And he goes, well, you're going to need to learn how to shoe your own stock.
Okay.
And I went, okay, well, maybe, you know, Dave Smith could help me learn that. And so I went and asked Dave Smith if he would, and he said, no, women aren't built right for that. So there's some resistance there. He says, your hips just aren't built the right way to be under a mule or horse.
So can you describe what he was thinking when he was saying that? What position do you need to get into, and how do you need to do it to shoe?
Well, you have to kind of squat. You squat, you know, and the front feet come in between your legs for you to work on them.
So you're facing toward the mule's tail. You're standing, like for its front foot, you're standing to its side, and you
right.
get its foot between your legs squatting, and then you can work
yep.
on it.
Yep, then I have my hands free to use both hands to work on it.
So it seems like you'd need to be strong, but you are. So was that thinking just a prejudice to his, or I mean, I...
Yeah, I think it was just a prejudice to his.
Okay.
So, and then on the back foot, you have to... You're crouched even lower because you want the back foot nestled in your lap so that you can use both hands to work on it. So you're crouched even lower.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah. So I had saved some money, and I'd looked up horseshoeing schools, and there was one in Oklahoma City. And they had, they had 2-week, 4-week, 8-week courses. So I signed up for an 8-week course, so that was 2 months. So Richard had to arrange for me to be laid off for 2 months so I could go to the school.
Was he good about that? Was he good about not just you but other employees who wanted to, sort of further their Park Service goals by training and special things like that?
Yeah, he was very supportive of me going, and I had also my time off. My furlough was usually in the winter, and now I had to do it in the summer. So
oh.
he arranged my schedule so that I could do that.
Nice.
And I drove down to Oklahoma City and spent 2 months down there learning some blacksmithing skills because you had to learn how to make your own shoes.
Oh, wow.
As well, so you made your own shoes out of the bar stock, and they wanted you to do different kinds of shoes.
Wow.
And then you went on field trips. Most people would bring their animals to the school to have them worked on for free, you know, knowing that it was students.
Okay.
But we also would get on a bus and head out to some farms to work out in the field. And I kept asking for mules. Where are the mules? I need to learn how to do mules. And so never ran into any mules, but I did a couple of donkeys
who
have similar feet.
What is the difference between a horse's foot and a mule's foot?
Well, a mule's foot's more like a donkey's, which is more upright. A horse's foot is splayed out a little bit more like a plate, and a mule's foot kind of goes upright, so they have a more concave feature to the inside of their foot.
Okay.
And they usually have a thicker wall. They usually have better feet overall.
Hmm. Okay.
Mules are, hybrid vigor, so they end up getting the best qualities generally from the horse and the donkey.
Huh, okay.
And
so you would take a piece of steel bar, like a round rod, and start getting it red hot and then beat the daylights out of it with a sledgehammer and bend it around into a U.
Mm-hmm.
How would you poke the holes through it for the nails?
Well, we had to make our own tools, too. And it was called a four-punch and a Pritchell. And the four-punch was sort of a blunt. It still had a point, but it was blunt. And you would start the nail hole with that, and then the Pritchell was the sharper one that you'd actually put the hole through.
So it would be red hot when you did that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Don't mess up. Did you get burned?
Yeah, a time or two.
Uh-huh.
You need it really hot. You kind of want it more white to yellow hot in order to have an easier time to bend things.
Yeah.
It starts red, it's cooling off, and so you're having to hit harder.
Hmm, okay. Okay.
But, so that was a good learning experience. And
So was that the training that Dave could have given you but didn't?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because there's a beautiful blacksmith shop there at the canyon.
Yeah.
And all the mules needed to be shod every 6 to 8 weeks.
So were the other packers doing that?
Stanley, I think he taught Stanley.
Okay.
Stanley was doing it. I think it was just Dave and Stanley at that time.
Okay. And why was it important that a packer know this skill? Why didn't a furrier know this skill and the packers pack?
Well, I mean, you find parks that will do that now, contract out the shoeing.
Okay.
But it's easier if you know it. If you know have that skill and you're out on the trail and you lose a shoe, or you're, you're not having a contract person come in every 6 to 8 weeks, you can just do it when it's needed to be done.
Right.
And so it just ends up being part of your so-called downtime when you're at the barn.
Mm-hmm.
That's just...
Yeah, it'd be part of your skills resume is knowing how to keep your animals in shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sounds like a good skill to know.
It's interesting. It can be hard on you. I don't do it too much anymore.
Well, there's a lot of things we don't do anymore. Cause it's the 1980s we're talking about after all.
I know. Well, and my guys now are barefoot, so they just needed a little trim here and there. But
yeah, yeah, okay. Cool. So did they give you like a certificate, a furrier certificate?
I did. I got a little diploma thing, yeah.
Cool.
And then I don't know where that is at the moment. But so I came back to Grand Canyon ready to go to work. And then I was going to be going to the blacksmith shop, whether Dave liked it or not at this point. And I think that's when I broke my finger.
Oh.
So I had another 2 months of not getting under an animal, with Dave. But when I was able to, at horseshoeing school, basically you were only doing like 2 feet a day, so it'd be two students on one animal.
Okay.
And so when I healed up and got to go back to shoeing, I went in and Dave had me do like 5 animals.
Wow.
It wasn't the whole thing. It wasn't trimming and shoeing. I think he did the trim and I did the shoe, but still...
That's 20 feet. Yeah.
Yeah, that's 4 feet per animal.
Right. 4 times 5 is 20, And is there, I mean, I'm just looking at the math here going, okay, well, I've got 10 hours, I've got 20 feet, I've got to do 2 feet an hour, and that's moving right along.
Yeah, well, yeah, he tried to kill me, I think.
Wow.
So anyway, I, you know, fucked up and said, okay, see you tomorrow, and went home and died that night, and then
oh my gosh.
Came back the next day ready to do it again. So I wasn't going to let him, you know, think he was, I couldn't do it.
Right.
So that was important to me.
Yeah. And so he, at one point, he must have said, well, I guess that's that.
Yeah, and then I remember kind of Stanley and I being in the blacksmith shop, just the two of us. So he must have relinquished control.
Okay.
And
was Stanley better about it?
Oh yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, Stanley was always good to me because we did a lot of hauling dirt. At one point, Tillman didn't come back, so then it was Stanley and I doing the dirt hauling. And we actually spent a lot of time together. He's a great guy.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
So then we had another project. I think that was in 82. Anyway, where we replanked the Kaibab suspension bridge.
Oh, boy. So let's see. That suspension bridge is how long?
Oh, I don't know how long it is. It's I really don't know. I know it's up there, too, like 150 feet up or something.
Yeah, and it's got what size planks are? And wait a minute, there's some rubber on top of the planks. Is that right?
Well, we didn't have any.
Okay.
There might be now, but and it seems to me we just planked over the old planks.
Oh.
But we had to drill. It was either creosoted or treated or something. But we had to climb over the railing, and, you know, there's like this angle iron lip underneath there because we had to put nuts on the bolts.
Okay.
From underneath.
Oh, so you couldn't just reach around and do that from the tread surface. You had to get on the outside of the railing and the barricade wall.
Yeah, and actually we were laying down underneath the bridge.
Were you on some sort of little harness and clipped in somewhere in case you, like, you know, sneezed
we
or something? And
in. Yeah, we were clipped in. The tools were clipped in.
Okay, good.
And so, yeah, so that was my first sort of any sort of climbing harness experience.
Oh, fun.
And I know when Richard had started talking about doing this project, I was like, oh, I want to be on that crew. And he goes, I thought you wanted to haul dirt.
Haul dirt and put shoes on mules, and now you want to go out and work
and
on the bridge.
Well, I want to do both.
Oh, cool.
So he was like, he kind of looked like he was angry at me, but the next thing I knew, I was on that crew.
Cool.
Yeah, so that was fun. And
did the planks come in by boat, or did you bring them down the trail by mule?
No, they must have been flown in.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't remember bringing them down by mule. I'm thinking they were flown.
Okay. Did you all have to prep the planks, or did maintenance do that?
I think we drilled them right then and there.
Okay, so you drilled.
And we had to count because we had to countersink.
Ah.
You know, couldn't have anything sticking up. So.
Right.
I'm gonna have to countersink them.
And how many bolts hold a typical plank in? All right.
I don't know. It was probably every foot, eight 18 inches or so.
Oh, so that's not just like two on either end. That's
No, they wanted it down, and there's like, I don't know, there was maybe like four planks across. I forget.
And how long were the bolts to get through your wood and the old wood?
Right, because I don't remember taking up the old stuff. So okay. I'm not positive on that, but I don't remember taking up. So I don't know.
Hmm.
A foot?
Yeah, okay.
And then it didn't matter if they were, you know, hanging out below. We just had to make sure there's nothing sticking up above.
Right, be careful when you crawl out of there. You don't whack your head on those things. And yeah. Did you drop anything? Drop anything down into the river by mistake, or did that go all right?
Oh, I'm sure I dropped something. I mean, wrenches and stuff are all tied on, but I imagine that the bolts. There was a bag of them hanging over. If somebody you were on belay, as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, and Sue was on that project. I remember Sue was on that project.
Cool.
So.
Okay. So that took, what, a couple months, a month or so?
I don't know. I don't think it took all that long once the planks were down there.
Okay.
Because we were going to have to stop traffic. I don't know. At one point, could stock cross the other bridge? I know it can't now.
Boy, I don't know. I haven't. I mean, it's all mesh. So, and they don't like that, right? Looking through there.
Yeah, no, it's all graded now. That definitely wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah. So, would it make sense that you would stop traffic when you were working on it? But, you know, once you would just gather up your tools and clear away, and the mules would take a step down in the middle of the walk as an old tread to the new tread, or a step up.
Yeah, but we wouldn't have been able, yeah, I mean, hiking traffic could have come through, but definitely not mules.
Hmm.
While we were on the bridge, everything would have had to have come completely off the bridge for them to come through.
Right, right. You there's no room, I mean.
So I don't remember how that worked.
Huh, okay.
But yeah, they wouldn't have been able to. No stock would have been able to come on while we were on the bridge.
All right. did you get into painting that thing at all, or was that to a different crew?
Yeah, no, I don't remember doing any painting.
Okay.
It was just the planks and the bolts.
Hmm. And so you'd stay in the bunkhouse for like a 9-day tour, and as you worked on that, or would you go out every day?
No, we'd stay at the bunkhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. And we did some helicoptering, but I think at that point they just slung the boards in.
Okay. And then what would you use to drill? An electric drill, a battery power? Do you have a generator out there with a power cord?
We might have had a generator.
Okay.
Yeah. But it was probably a gas-powered drill, I would think. So.
Yeah, just trying to figure out how the, you know, some of the tools involved would have worked there. Were any boats going by while you were working on that?
Well, there must have been. I mean, I kind of don't remember. You know, everybody stops right there on the other side.
Right.
And I know we camped right above it.
Oh.
You know, when we were on the river, we could camp right above.
Up at Cremation.
And then sort of row to Phantom for supply and then row back up.
Yeah, you can row across to Roy's Beach or where Roy's Beach used to be before the sand all went away. Then walk down to Phantom, and then walk back and get your boat and go back over to Cremation on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well, that's a fun project.
Yeah, it was. So, yeah, and at some point I lived... Did you know Linda Knutson?
No, but I know a Dave Knutson.
No, I don't think so. Anyway, we became... After Sue left, she went back to Pennsylvania and got married. I became good friends with Linda, and we had this little place out. It was out by the railroad tracks out, you know, in the woods of Tucson.
Oh.
Coconino Siding or something like that.
Was that out by Eric Gase's place?
I don't know. It was out. It was just sort of out in the middle of nowhere.
On
I loved it.
On the Rawell Road?
Yeah. Well, maybe, yeah, off the Rawell Road. I always called it Rawell Road because I had a hard time with the R's and the W's.
Yeah, Sue Hovey and Eric Gase had a place out there. An old mining, patented mining claim that had some cabins out there. Do those names ring a bell?
No, not really.
Okay.
There was a gal, her name was Mindy
Carlsberg.
And she had a couple of kids and her husband died in a
helicopter crash.
Yeah.
Carlsberger. Yeah.
Yeah. That
yeah, that's the place. Cool.
Okay, well, that, we weren't at that place. We were a little further out. But I loved that place that Mindy lived in.
Nice. So now you've got your own housing, and so you just drive into work during the, you know, for the day.
Yeah, I'm still gone for the 9 days or whatever.
Okay.
But, and I think we got out of there by wintertime because I didn't have the rig to get through the...
Oh, the snow.
And the mud.
Hmm, okay.
But... Yeah, I don't know where I went then, but...
Okay. So, at one point, you decided to leave Grand Canyon.
Yeah?
How did that come about?
Well, Richard had already left.
Okay.
And, and it was getting, it was different after he left. It was, you know, they're kind of changing things up a little bit. And Pete was now in the office, and it was just, I don't know, it wasn't quite the same. And anyway, one day he calls me and says, you know, they hadn't had stock up here in 10 years at the Olympics. Because the trails foreman before him believed everybody should pack everything on their back. And he said he was going to start the stock program back up and for me to put in my application. So that's pretty much what I did. And he hired me.
Cool.
And,
you know, before we head in that direction, in the 1980s, around this time, I know that Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R,
mm-hmm.
had mentioned that Dick Marks, seems like something superintendents like to do is kind of change up the structure of things.
Yeah.
And I guess the river crew lost their independence and became a district in the corridor, or in the backcountry or something like that. And I wonder if trails, there were some changes in trails as well.
Well, I know they eventually went to, they started having, after I left, I heard they'd started having a lot of accidents with people. not really knowing how to ride, yet here they are riding and packing their own gear.
Oh.
So I think they switched it to there was your packers and then there was your trail crew.
Okay.
And which is kind of how it is up here, you know, your trail crew didn't ride. Your packers packed all your gear in and dropped you off or bumped you up or whatever needed to happen.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of makes sense because, you know, packers know large animals and trail crew people might not.
Right.
So I'm confused about the accidents. Was that because the trail crew people were packing and they didn't know large animals?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, okay.
But packing and riding, I mean, you know, and the canyons are not really, of course, they didn't up here either. It's a good place to have accidents.
Well, it is. So. You've got your animal and its nature, and you've got the terrain, and then you've got the tourists.
Yeah.
Just hiking on day hikes or backpacking in and out, and they don't know how to manage themselves around large animals.
No.
So that's a whole nother factor.
Yes, for sure.
Hmm.
But, you know, I think at the canyon they have things on the bulletin board at trailheads that tell people how to respond when you need a mule train.
Right.
Did that
always happen that way?
No, but I was not shy about telling them exactly what I wanted them to do.
Great. Yeah.
You know, to get off the trail and stand still and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Get over against the wall and don't move.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, I'm wondering if this would be a good place to put a comma here in our discussions, and then next time we would pick up going up to Olympic National Park and how that worked, unless there's something else you'd like to put in about your time at Grand Canyon.
I can't think of anything at the moment.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 3, oral history interview with Claire Donato. Today is Sunday, November 29th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin, and Claire, thank you so very much.
You're quite welcome.